All right, thank you. Let's see if we can get my slides back up here. You know about how to do the test?
I got it, no problem. And your laptop.
There we go. All right. Yes, welcome. My name is Dan Sharma, as you may already know by now. And I'm here to talk about NetBSD within the Summer of Code that was sponsored by Google. I work as a system administrator over across the river at Stevens Institute of Technology in the computer science department, where we have a large number of NetBSD machines and systems in general. So I maintain those for a living. And I get to play around with a lot of NetBSD stuff over there, and I get to do a lot of package store stuff over there. And I ended up becoming a developer for NetBSD, which is why you see my address there as jsharma@netbsd.org. And please do feel free to contact me at that address with any questions whatsoever about tonight's talk or whatever you may want to talk about. The next little number down there is the fingerprint of my PGP key, so if you know what this is, then you can probably understand what I'm saying here. Otherwise, you can ignore it happily, and it is perfectly fine. But let's talk about what this whole Summer of Code is. As George already mentioned, NetBSD's Google Summer of Code was a project that was initiated by Google, everybody's favorite search engine, in their strive for world dominance to get more people coding open source code. And I suspect to look for skilled people they could hire worldwide, presumably. What they said is, okay, we pay students $4,500 if they write open source code, which sounds like a pretty damn good deal to anybody involved. So of course people got very excited about this, and many people got involved in this, and we, the NetBSD project, also happened to get our hands on there. And I'll present what kind of projects we've had within NetBSD and how we dealt with it. So, let's see. First of all, Summer of Code. Hey, what is that? When Google announced it, they were handing out these flyers. They were, found online, you could find them in schools, anywhere, which plainly stated, want to write open source code this summer? Want to make money? Want to do both? And of course the answer is yes, and this pretty much summed it up. It just explained that anybody who would want to participate in the Google Summer of Code would have to be a registered student anywhere worldwide. It turned out that it was not particularly easy always to nail down what actually constitutes a student. I'm not sure how far part-time students were considered. I don't believe they were. Anybody who would want to participate would have to be a full-time student at a university that would be recognized as such. So there are lots of students who would apply for this different positions and would want to write code and get paid for it, and just follow their passion, basically, because as we all know, open source code is written to a large part by people who are just simply enthusiastic about it. Many people also having to get paid for it, and that even makes them probably more enthusiastic, but nevertheless, the majority of the work that, for example, the NetBSD project is involved in is plain open source work that is not paid for by other people. And people do it just because they like doing it and because they want to share their work. So the thought of actually for students to be able to write open source code over the summer and get paid for that must have been very appealing. Because otherwise, what would they have to do? They would have to go around and find a summer job. They would have to flip burgers somewhere. And as Google said, pretty much wasting their minds over those couple of weeks because they're computer science students, for example, that could otherwise much better hone their skills on writing code. And this would allow them to do that. So you see those flyers and you see Google offering money for it, and you think, okay, we just add a little bit of code in this, and then we'll end up with something like this. So we just have the Summer of Code, we're sitting in a lounge chair, and we're writing code, and we're getting paid for it, and everything's peachy. And interestingly enough, this is probably how things work out for many people. As far as I can tell from the NetBSD project, we've got a lot of good code and a lot of good projects that people took place in. And I know that at least one developer went on vacation while he was writing code. He just took his laptop and he probably was sitting there just like that and writing his code. So the appeal there is rather obvious. Now, these pictures that I'm showing here in my slides, so I would like to point out that of course all of those are retrieved through the Google search image, search images server, which if you plug in the phrase, summer of code, you get all those pictures. For example, this one there, which even though it may look a little bit like me, is not me in effect, it's somebody else. As usual, when you plug anything into Google and just search around for a little while, you come up with odd little things. For example, here we have another instance of the picture that came up for the Summer of Code. Somehow, the Summer of Code is associated with lots of girls in bikinis running on the beach. I'm sure that many students would be interested in this, but I would say boldly that this is completely gratuitous. My French is somewhat rusty, but looking at the text next to it, I cannot see any possible connection whatsoever between the Summer of Code and this picture. But as I said, I stumbled upon all these pictures, so I thought I'd throw it in there for the mix. Alright, so our students are looking for fame and money, recognition of the open source community, maybe even for girls in bikini on the beach, who knows. So they have a certain number of deadlines to observe. And the interesting thing here is that this was actually done very, very quickly. This whole project came around within a couple of days as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure that Google put a lot more planning into this whole business, into the concept, but once it was announced, which happened on May 31st, there was not much time left. If you look at the deadlines, you'll know that May 31st, they pretty much announced this concept of saying, okay, we pay people money, we say, you can write open source code and we will pay you for it. And by June 14th, you would have to have your final application that you would have to hand in. In order to have a successful application, the students would have to first find a mentoring organization, which would need to oversee the students. Mentoring organizations are any and all organizations that are open source organizations that have gotten in contact with Google about this, or that Google has gotten in contact with them, and then agreed upon taking over a couple of students and to overseeing them, to mentoring them, and then to help them with their code, with their development. Initially, when this was announced on May 31st, on the website, code.google.com, when they made their first announcement, there were only a handful of mentoring organizations. There were about five or six, I believe, that included the Perl Foundation, the Python Foundation, GNOME Foundation, that's it, I think. I looked at four or five in total. That, of course, makes it very hard for all this interest that was generated to say, oh, I want to have something that is overlooked by my mentor organization XYZ. One of the overlooking mentor organizations was Google itself. So, of course, tons of students would be interested in having their project done with Google, by Google, for Google, just so that they can actually be associated with Google and have on the resume, for example, I developed my project with Google. So I assume that what happened during those first days, A, lots of students expressed interest and lots of people flooded them with emails asking, how can I participate, how can I take a part in this? And on the other hand, a number of other organizations said, wait a second, why aren't we on this list? For example, NetBSD was not on that list initially. And we said, wait a second, this sounds like such a great idea. It would be so great to have students that we can oversee, that we can basically hire for money, pay them money to develop code for us, and it's open source code that we can integrate later on if it's good enough. Why are we on this list? Why can't we get in on this? And so there was a lot of back and forth on the emailing list that were quickly set up there. And so Google then decided, okay, we allow a couple of more other mentoring organizations. These mentoring organizations have to contact us and we will see if we get them, which happens on June 1st, which is the next day. So depending on what time zone you're in, you don't really have much time to get things going there. This got us from the NetBSD project rattling around pretty busily in order to get involved in this. Because first of all, we had to ask the developer body, are we interested in this? Do we want to participate in this? This is a general common decision that we had to make all of us together. So usually, if you involve, in my experience, any more than, say, 10 people in the decision-making process, it's unlikely you will get to a conclusion within one day. So what we basically had to do is step up and say, okay, we're participating in this, we don't see a downside, let's talk about the details later on. and this is pretty much what I did. I looked at the stuff and I talked to a couple of other NetBSD developers, and they said, okay, there really is no downside to this. If you look at what you're getting, let's look at the details. Google says you're paying a student money, $4,500. In addition, they're paying $500 to each mentoring organization per student, just for the effort that the mentoring organization does for overlooking the student, for mentoring the students. Okay, so there's $500 involved for the organization. Google says whatever the student produces, you are not obligated to include in your source stream. This would be a terrible burden because you could not make the promise beforehand to say, okay, we're taking whatever the students are handing us and then take it into our repository. We have a responsibility to represent the quality that people are used to from the NetBSD project, and I'm sure other projects do the same way. If they say, okay, we can only import code if we actually agree that it's decent code, that it's cleanly written, and it's worthy of being included in our project. Okay, so we're not forced to actually include the code either. We might get money. So in the worst case scenario, we have a couple of projects that are overlooked by some of our developers as mentors, and the mentors may waste some time, say 5 to 10 hours a week or so over the summer, and that is the worst case scenario. The best case scenario, on the other hand, looks pretty appealing. Not only do you get n times $500 for all your n students, but in addition, you get great code, which is of course much more valuable than the money itself. You can actually get new developers who can produce more code later on, because anybody who participates in this project and who picks you as the mentoring organization is likely interested in developing code with you.
Is there a licensing requirement? I mean, could it be any open source?
There was the licensing requirement for Google was it needs to be open source, meaning approved by the Open Source Initiative. So therefore, any recognized open source project could participate. Of course, the BSD family, pretty trivial, with the BSD license can easily fit into this. GPL was acceptable as an open source license, the Apache license, MIT license, all these different licenses. Open source, as long as recognized on the list of open source licenses, anybody could participate. And again, it's not a drawback for the mentoring organization because they can say, we only take students who will write code with this license. And if the student who files his application says, oh, I want to write code with another license, and the mentoring organization does not agree, they can say, well, we will not take you as a mentoring student. Public domain code, I'm not sure, I don't recall. You can probably look that up on the website later on. But I believe that the public domain, is that accepted on the OSI list?
I think what
Google said is depends on what OSI, the Open Source Initiative, lists as accepted licenses. And I'm not sure if public domain is on there. I think it is, actually. So anyway, there's no downside in that way. So the best case scenario, as I said, is to gain interest, to gain exposure in the open source community, to get a little bit of money, and to get actual code, get features implemented that you're missing, and to get maybe even future developers in the long run is invaluable. So therefore, we had to really spin around and try to get in on there, and we immediately contacted Google and we said, okay, we want to get in this, how do we do this? And Google said, okay, all you have to do is give us 2 people that we can contact, and then give us a list of suggested projects you have to make available online publicly that students can look at. Okay, so within one day, we threw together a list of suggested projects, which we'll take a look at later on. We contacted them, and we got in on that, and we're very glad we did. In the end, everything was worked out decently for us. The FreeBSD project also managed to get in on this, and I'm very glad that they did, because obviously all the BSDs share certain code bases, and we were looking forward to including projects from other mentoring organizations in our project, too. Unfortunately, neither OpenBSD or DragonflyBSD or Darwin were included or managed to get into this list of accepted mentors. But at the end of June 1st, there were a list of about 25 to 30 mentors. So that's a significant increase, and it shows just how much buzz this whole thing had generated, how much people were interested in this. Then you had the interim period, where you have the, as they say, back and forth with applicants on the Summer Discuss Google group. So they set up a mailing list for this project, and they said, okay, this is where students who are interested in this can ask questions. And boy, did they. There were lots and lots of students and lots of questions. Within those 14 days, on this list alone, I received some 3,400 mails, And many of them were repetitive. Many of them were frequently asked questions. And I have to say, the people at Google did a great job at actually answering all the questions and being patient. Every now and then they had to say, okay, this has been answered beforehand. Look at the website, read the frequently asked questions. But in general, they have been dealing with every individual question that came up that has been addressed at least once by one person from Google. And I found it rather impressive. So for 2 weeks, they've been bantering back and forth with students because students said, wait a second, I live in this country, and how do you verify that I'm a student? And they say, well, don't worry about it, we deal with it. You will contact your university and you'll find out whether or not you're a student or not. And then, of course, the inevitable questions came up about people who might be cheating, people who say, but if I hire somebody for $2,000 to write the code and I hand it in, and then I get the $4,000, and so on and so on. And I have the impression that Google was very benevolent in general. They said, we trust you not to cheat. Of course, there are ways that we cannot possibly prevent you from cheating, but please don't do it, and we will try to do our best to get everything in order. But if you do find out about this, you don't get the money, of course. But anyway, another aspect that's regarding this cheating business. Alright, let's see if we can get that on there. Another aspect regarding this cheating business is that the students get $500 up front. Because students, being rather poor, don't want to be working all summer in the hopes that maybe they get money at the end. Many students cannot even afford that anyway, so they need to get some money up front. So Google said we will pay every student $500 up front. And then at the end of the semester, at the end of the summer, we will see whether or not they get the money if they actually did do the work that they said they would do. So there are lots and lots of questions on this mailing list there. And then on June 14th was the deadline for the submissions. Students had to submit their work through the web front end that Google had set up, which would then be transferred to Google. Google would look at them, and then Google would hand them off to the mentoring organization, to different ones. On June 14th, of course, there was another spike of emails going around because once everybody had submitted their application, they said, well, am I in or what? Of course, Google said, no, we will not answer this until June 24th, but in those 10 days, I got another 2,400 emails with questions where people said, did I get approved? Why didn't I get approved? Because it was just a waiting period. People are anxious to get in there. Anyway, so then 10 days later, there was the deadline where it says whether or not an application is approved or rejected. Again, it's a short time frame. In those 10 days, we had to work with Google together, or Google rather had to accommodate all the mentoring organizations to hand over the application that were given to a particular project. A student could apply for a project based on saying, I talked to my mentoring organizations, or I picked something from their website. They could send and fill that in. And then Google would say, okay, we hand it over to you, and then PSD gets a whole stack of applications, and we have to then say which one we actually want to approve. And we'll see in a moment how we did that. All right, after that, there's some coding in there. Google gave a preliminary progress report at OSCon, which I regretfully did not go to, so I don't know how that worked out. September 1st was the deadline. September 1st was the date where students would have to submit their code, or at least take a snapshot and say, this is what I've done over the summer, and whether or not you get the money, we will see. Then we have another 30 days to get all the advisor feedback in, where we have to evaluate the code that the students submitted. We have to say whether or not they deserve the money, if the work was good, if all goals were achieved, and so on. And supposedly, on October 1st, there was the idea, one would announce these successful applicants, and the final checks are cut, and send t-shirts. T-shirts are amazingly interesting. It's unbelievable. All the mails from the mailing list, people are like, oh, I don't really care about the money, I just want the t-shirt. And people are saying, oh, what can I do if I don't get accepted, but can I still get a t-shirt? These t-shirts, they must be selling on eBay in a couple of weeks for a lot of money, I'm quite sure of that. Unfortunately, they didn't quite send them out in time, otherwise I would be probably wearing my t-shirt now, but alas. All right, so let's take a look at the projects that we had on our list. When we were asked, or when we said we want to participate in the Google Summer of Code, we said, okay, let's get together with an idea of project that we can do. Now, asking the developer body of an open source project to say, what would be your idea to give a student to do over the summer, is an interesting experience. You'll find that many people who are very great coders will say, oh, why don't you implement X, where X is a rather complex system and could not possibly be done by a student over the summer. So we don't have to sit down and figure out what project we can offer them. But again, this was just within a 1 day time frame. So we threw it together with a whole bunch of suggestions from all of our various different areas. Namely from the NetBSD ports, the different platforms, the userland, the kernel, we have file system networking, package host projects, and of course the ever so popular miscellaneous. So for the ports, we had suggested, okay, something that is reasonable to be done might be porting NetBSD to the SDI often and origin machines. If you are familiar with the SDI machines, they all are slightly different and there are certain tweaks in order to get them ported over. Those differ a little bit from the architecture that they support would have been nice. Support for NMULES systems would have been nice. Support for the ZORs or for IA64. Now, actually, support for the IA64 is currently a work in progress. We actually have people working on that now. Which also happened over the summer, but not as part of Summer of Code. But nevertheless, we actually recently put together a website, one of our port pages for IA64, because we're nearing the point in time where we can actually say, okay, we have IA64 support, so we're very excited about that. Other suggested projects in the userland were, for example, a Wi-Fi browser, just the userland application that allows you to check what hotspots you have available, what strength they are, and so on and so on. We have a BSD license, privacy guard, white character supporting cursors, BSD license rsync replacement, which was always my favorite because I deal with rsync a lot and sometimes it doesn't work so well, so I've asked people if they could write me a better one, so far nobody has come up for that yet. We have in the NetBSD kernel itself, various improvements that you suggested for just in general, improve FFS, improve caching, improve writing QLS. And you will notice these first three are typical developer responses to what needs to be done. Make that better. All right, but it's not really a clear description. It's very difficult for a student to say, okay, how do I make this better? Where do I start? NetBSD block device driver NAND flashes, flash compilation system, compressed cache system, soft tap on slow machines, real-time support, Bluetooth support, these things are all very complex and require that the user already or the developing student already has a pretty in-depth understanding of what's going on in the kernel at that time when they start out. So unfortunately we didn't get many responses to these kernel suggestions. File systems. File systems are always popular because you can't have too many. So you have support for all these different file systems there. For example, we wanted to have a tool to create ISO file systems. Somebody said, hey, XFS is a great file system. How about somebody writes XFS support? Well, again, this is probably more than most people can do over the course of 2 months approximately, especially writing from sketch. Exactly. Of course, with the restriction of saying BSD license, because there currently is a GPL licensed read support for XFS, I believe, and somebody could port that. Then we have JFS support, HFS Plus support, journaling for UFS would have been very interesting. It's not all that complex. Somebody who has an understanding of file systems could probably actually implement journaling for a UFS file system. ACLs was another one of those pie-in-the-sky dreams that we always come up with and say, it would be really nice to get this over here. An efficient memory file system, or get resized FFS to be actually working correctly, or even better than it does right now. So those were some of the things we dreamed of. Some more are networking. Then we have the NDIS network driver, policy routing, clean up routing code, clean up, what is ring rate, zero pump. Then we have package source, of course, where you have endless projects just by saying, okay, just integrate one package, another package, and so on, which would not have been complex enough. Instead, we would rather have something like unprivileged package source builds, which work to a certain degree, but not completely. So somebody could do some work there. Or parallel modules. If you remember my last presentation here at the NYC Bug was on package source, and I said, okay, we have certain infrastructure in place to do modules, where we build every single package that we have available and then make it into binary packages and upload them. It would be nice if we could do this in parallel, so we use actual parallelism. There's some work in progress there, which was done by Johnny Lamb. You can contact if you are interested in helping us out with that. Yeah. Miscellaneous SIS packages have been floating around for a long time. Now, we said we want to have Aura-based system to do system packages, to have actual package system, allow us to update only part of the operating system with binary commands, similar to what you do with Hackerset, with the NAS. Floating valve run, all these things were just some of the suggestions. And these are the things that we put up on the website, and that's what students responded to later on. Notice that we again here have some work in progress where we say, okay, the bootloader works to a certain degree now, there's already entry, and we're getting there. If you look at all the different projects that we have there, you notice that the summer of code quickly turns into the end of summer because we have so many projects there, so much work to do. So we all hope very much that Google will do this again, that we can hire more people to get involved in this and to get other bits that need to get done integrated into our source field. And I believe that Google has indicated that yes, they are interested in doing this again, but no, they cannot actually say when they're going to do it again. But so we shall see. All right. So as I said, we get all these applications, we get a lot of feedback from the students on the mailing list itself, and then there's a deadline. On the deadline, we get access to a web front end which says, okay, this is a list of different projects that students have selected for NetBSD. And they provide them to us in the web front end, which we can then use to rate the different projects and to read them out and do all these different things. And we have to actually make a decision pretty quickly. Within about 1 week, we had to nail down our list of preferred projects to hand it back to Google so they can review them and they can then announce them. Yes, people could do second choices. Every student could apply more than once on time as often as they like. We had several people who said, though I noticed later on, I applied for this project and I applied for that project, and whichever I get chosen for, I will then make a decision if I happen to be lucky enough to get chosen for both. But Google ruled out you cannot do two at a time. You cannot accept two projects at a time. But it was fair game to apply for more than one, definitely. So we have this list of projects, and we have to deal with them, and we have to figure out what is going on. And it was interesting to see the quality of the student submissions. There was some that were detailed. They listed basically week by week how they would make progress or what they would research. How they would implement a certain feature, and so on and so on. And others sent us basically a copy of the website that we had put up, where they said, copy and paste this project, I'll do that. Well, not really what you're looking for that necessarily right there. I think one of my favorite projects was actually where a student, the entire application consisted of, I am doing something about server based on Linux, including Linux kernel adapted for the server. That was the application that the student submitted to get this $4,500 grant from Google to do that NetBSD work, supposedly. We had to read those out. So a couple of them, as you can tell, are clearly obvious rejects that we can very easily go through, and this is what we did as a small team before handing it off to the developer body. So only a couple of us, I think there are four people involved, myself and Hubert Feierer, who you may have heard about, he is also on the certification efforts involved in there, and who's currently visiting here in the US and couldn't make it, unfortunately, tonight. And a couple of others. So we went to that, quickly weeded out the obvious, the uninteresting projects that would not possibly accept it because clearly the student lacked the enthusiasm to come up with a decent description of what they might be doing. After that, we would make a list of the remaining applications and present them to the developer body. We say, okay, everybody, this is the list of projects we have. Let's see, what do you think is interesting in this part? What do you think needs to be done? What do you think, which of these students are most promising? Do you know any of the students, maybe? Have you worked with any of them? So all these different questions we had to ask to see if we can rank them a little bit higher. So as we got the feedback, we would then rank them up again, basically assigning actual numbers to it, say, okay, 5 points for recommendations from the developer because they have worked with them previously and says it's a great coder or something like that. After that, we need to figure out who will overlook the project because each project needs to have at least one developer who will actually guide the student, who will take the student by the hand and say, okay, if your questions come to me, or who will actually review code. If the code is given by the student, then the developer can say, well, this was great, but maybe you should do it this way, or maybe you should do it another way. Or it says, okay, this is great, you can commit this, it's ready to go. So there's a certain number of, a certain amount of time involved that a developer needs to be willing and able to put into this, in addition to any volunteer developer's actual efforts to begin with. After all, at BSD, as I said before, is a volunteer project. We all do this on our free time, except for the lucky few who get paid. And if you actually have to chip in another 10, 15 hours a week or so, it can be a burden. So we have to see which of the developers would be interested in overseeing a student, to guide a student, to take them by the hand, and to let them see how we do things in that BSD land. After we've got our list of mentors, then we will then again reshuffle the whole list, sort them, rank it again by saying, okay, now we know the projects we're interested in. We can kind of tell of what the students' capabilities are. Maybe we talk to the students if we have questions, which we've done. We see if the mentors are available, which ones are there. And eventually, we've got this list of prioritized projects, and we hand it back to the developer body and say, okay, now you guys vote. You say, which one is your favorite project? If it's your favorite project, we get a vote for it, it gets 1 point. And then, at the end of the day, we sum it all up, and we get a whole list of numbers, and this is the list in ranking that we hand back to Google. Google then will decide on the number of mentorships that are awarded to each organization. So they pick them by the top-ranked applications. Originally, Google had said that they would offer enough funds for 200 students. After it became very clear that it's overwhelming interest in the project by students worldwide from everywhere, they upped it to 400, so they quickly doubled this. According to the mailing list traffic that I've been following, it probably went kind of like this. Christy Bona, who was the main lead on this project, went to a cafeteria. And some lunch went into Sergey Brin. Sergey says, so, how's the summer of code thing going? Oh, it's great. I wish we could do more. Well, double the number. All right. And that was it. So, considering that they spend $5,000 per student, and they now have 400, that's a chunk of cash that suddenly gets put into open source there. Now, I'm not much of a person with corporate experience, so this is all foreign to me. And I know that some people say, well, the $2 million that they're putting in there is, you know, some shame given the exposure that they get from this. But just, I thought it was kind of curious to see somebody say from 1 million to 2 million, just like that in a win. So Google then said, okay, we now have 400 students that we want to award with this scholarship, basically. And they have to say, by each application, and hand them out. Now what they did, as far as I can tell, is that they actually gave percentage-wise to the number of applications received for a mentoring organization. They gave a certain percentage then to this organization. So that an organization that has 3,000 applicants would get a lot more applicants than an organization that only has 100. So therefore, this organization is a little bit smaller, say, in a PhD project compared to Google, would get a lot fewer people to oversee and to mentor. So we had a total of 96 applications in general, which was on the lower end of the different organizations. We are a rather small project if you compare it. FreeBSD, for example, has many more developers than we have, has a much larger user base, and had many more applications, and they did get awarded many more applications. But anyway, out of our 96 applications in total, we then picked the following 7 projects. And 7 projects were actually, as far as I can tell, a fairly good number. It turned out to be rather successful for us.
Excuse me.
Alright, so we got our 7 applications that we accepted, that we said we have the most interest in, and that we think are the most likely to succeed. Of course, we have other interests, but we thought there's no way that this student who applied for this could possibly actually get this done. So the applications that we accepted were, for project number 1, DPG, the BSD License Privacy Guard, PGP. Which I'm very excited about that we got this and to the state that it got into, because it is tremendously useful. Currently, the only open source implementation is GNU-PG, and it has its own drawbacks, and we are very excited to have a BSD license implementation. in development that can be used to do actual PGP. Then we have HFS Plus, support for the HFS Plus file system, which sounded appealing enough, given that nowadays all the BSD people buy Macintosh computers, and all the Apple has HFS Plus file systems, and you want to be able to mount them if you do a boot them, for example, or if you interact with them in general. Yes. Well, that might be interesting. We are not there yet, as you will see when we talk about this, but if it's a so-called file system, there's nothing to prevent you from actually having HFS Plus as your chosen file system. So that's certainly possible. And might be the case indeed. I mean, most of our, all these laptops or NetBSD runs on them quite well actually, and PPC is one of our large platforms, which large user base next to i386 and a couple of others, but NetBSD is definitely high up there. So there was interest there, and our people who are familiar with the internals of file systems said, okay, HFS Plus support, it's a good project for a summer, if somebody had experience in that, but it's doable. It can be done within the summer, or brought to a certain stage where we can say, okay, now we've got a point where we can rip it into shape, maybe even import it into a source tree, and then work on this from there. So people saw that was a good project. Then we have the NDIS network driver port, which is available for free BSD, but not for NetBSD. And so we said, hey, it would be a good project to have somebody port it over to our platform. And you will see that we have, as you can tell, already three very different projects. Now, one of them is completely userland, one is a file system, and one is porting from some other platform. So we have a lot of different, completely different projects there, which makes the whole thing very interesting. I forgot to mention that another restriction of the summer of code was that it would be a summer of code. You would actually have to write code when you're doing when you're applying. Other people have applied saying, oh, I want to do this open source project where I'm doing a database, or where I review the website, or something like that, or I do documentation, for example, which are all very valuable, very important parts of open source work. But in this instance, under the Google Summer of Code, they could not have applied for it because it was specifically said it needs to be writing actual code, doing something that is more computer science centric, I believe. Which leads me back to assuming that they're looking to hire some of those people. Then we have another file system, TempFS, an official memory file system. We have UserFS, the user space file system hooks, which is also interesting. We have wide character support for the Cursus library. And we have some networking project called ZeroCon, which also is one of our projects. So we have got these seven projects. If you look at the distribution of the people of where they are from and how we're working, you will notice that this pretty much reflects how the PSD works to a large degree. We have a total of 7 students, we have a total of 11 mentors, and then the 2 blue dots are the 2 people who have been overlooking the Summer of Code, which are myself, New York City obviously, and who is Fire from Germany. So we have a total of, as I said, 7 students from, I believe, 5 nations, 11 mentors from, I think, 4 nations, and 2 organizers from, well, 1.5 nations, given that I also happen to be German and therefore can count as a full different nationality. But you can see that we are spread out all over the globe, as is common in a widespread open source projects, at least as far as I'm concerned, or as I'm familiar with. I'm sure there are many open source projects where developers are more centralized, more localized, but NetBSD has always been spread out over the globe and has communicated over the internet, which is where we got our name from after all. So you'll notice we have people coming from America, from the different countries in Europe. We have this single island there in China, and we have a couple of people down in Australia. As I said, we place pretty much the distribution of all of our developers. All right. So let's see. Let's go into these different projects. Now, in order to present these different projects to you, I have to admit that I'm not able to actually give you all the details of every single project, simply because they each cover completely different days, and none of them are my expertise, which is nothing really in particular. I'm more one of those admin types who do like all kinds of things, rather than one thing in particular. So all that I can do here is basically present to you what I have read in the last couple of weeks on the different websites that we have set up for this, that our students have submitted the feedback to us, the mentors have submitted the feedback, and I think I summarized this for you. And you could, of course, just go out on your own and research all this stuff, but I know you're a lazy bunch, so that's why I came here to present to you what's going on. So HFS Plus was one of our projects, as you said. We have no HFS support it's currently available for us, and neither NetBSD nor FreeBSD. So we were looking forward to getting this into our tree, and we said we're interested in that. There is a good amount of work on our project according to the people who know about this stuff, and then we picked our students based on the applications, and we did pick, I think, 3 or 4 different applications for HFS Plus. So we had to actually choose one person off them. Group work was not allowed in the summer of school. Each work had to be done by an individual student, which is unfortunate, but I understand from an organizational point of view that school would have a hard time dealing with all the money and the taxes and all the other organizational stuff that's involved in actually funding group work. So they had restricted it to create 1 student per project, which is why they only have 1 developing student. In this case, we have 1 mentoring and a PhD developer. So student one.
Did that hold back, say,
Apple from contributing, like, Apple developers helping
on HFS? No, this is only for the duration of the summer of code. Duration, but
Apple after the summer of code is over, it's up for anybody. And what they've also said is, anything that is developed needs to be developed on an open source site. So what many people have done is they set up their own repository on SourceForge, on Solana or whatnot. And what we have done in NetBSD, in order to facilitate the task for our students to get them involved in how to set up a source repository and all this stuff, we have set up an umbrella project on SourceForge, which was called NetBSD-SOC, a summer of code, where we have said, okay, all students' different codes go into this one project on this one SourceForge, and you can check it out by checking out individual modules, which takes away from the student the responsibility to have to set up their own repository and to deal with all this stuff, and we thought it was probably a good idea. But so that means the code is available for everybody during the entire operation of the summer of code. Anybody could chip in, and there's nothing that prevents anybody from secretly sending patches to the student and the student committing them. But again, there are certain ways that, you know, if somebody who wants to see it will see it. That we, of course, hope that nobody did, and as far as we can tell, nobody did. Yes? Excuse me? Right. I mean, they could, but it's... Oh, no, excuse me. The question was, this is attractive to students because they could not do this on their own. It is, I mean, they could do it on their own, but students, being a lazy bunch in my experience, usually need a little bit of motivation there, which is why we have the whole mentor-student member relationship. And us helping them by providing the umbrella project and source code, I think, help them also to just dive right into the code and start writing code rather than having to deal with the trivial little peskiness of setting up a repository and so on. And as I said, the code is available during the entire operation of the summer of code for anybody to inspect. And it's then afterwards also available because it's an open source project. Afterwards, the mentoring organization is free to do whatever they want to do with the code. They can choose to import it to their repository, or they can choose to abandon it. But once it's been open source, it's very hard to keep the lid on it if somebody wanted to do that. So it's not going to actually happen. So we said we cannot give the student right commit privileges to our CVS repository right away. Of course not. No, we can do that. I know that certain smaller open source projects did actually give them right access to their source repository, but we could obviously not do that. Anyway, so as I said, we've got our student mentor here, a student relationship here. We've got these students, and let's see. Those two are located in these two areas. We have Yevgeny, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, living in Chicago, and the student one down in San Diego. And the two of them will sit together happily, far distant from each other, but working closely together, nevertheless, just like open source usually works for us. So what they said, what we need to do for HFS, or what we said, what we wanted to see was there was a file system that needs to be read-writable in order to allow us to actually have files on there and access them perfectly. So this was the original thought. then during the first week or so, it became clear that this is not a realistic goal for this particular student, and we said, okay, we adjust our deliverables, which we are free to do under the rules, and say, okay, we will say, this is what we want to get done. So the adjustment, the deliverables were a little bit adjusted because it was found slightly too ambitious. And this is the feedback that I got from the mentors when I asked them how this project worked out. This student in particular did not have much of an FPSD background, which was interesting because most of the other ones did have a very strong background in FPSD. So being a risk student needed a lot more guiding, a lot more hand-holding to get them into how does an FPSD kernel work, how does an FPSD file system, how do they work, and what kind of, what is good style, what is bad style considered in our source repository. So they need a little bit more time there to get into this. But nevertheless, a basic HFS+ file system support was completed on time, and it is actually, I believe, it's currently read-only. But nevertheless, at least you can now mount your laptops or your other Macs file system and you can get access to the files. It is not yet ready for import into the NetBSD source tree. There still needs to be a little bit of work done, a little bit of cleanup done. After all, over the summer, what the students have done, they had to have their pencils down on September 1st, so it's only a month ago. And our mentors, of course, have other things to do, so we have not really been able to focus in particular on every single one to get it ready to get into the source tree. But I've been told that the code looks good enough to actually be realistically imported at some point. The student has, this is one of the few students who, after the summer of code was over, actually returned to regular student work mostly and did not do much work on this continuum. Other students, I've heard, have been very adamant and have been coding away ever since they started and have not stopped yet. And they're still, as far as I'm concerned, right now writing code, and that's a great thing. However, we deem this a success. It was, it has met all the deliverables, even if the deliverables had to be adjusted earlier on, but nevertheless, the student has shown enough learning experience, has shown that certain work was done. So they got a basic HFS+ file system support, therefore we say this project worked out pretty well, actually. We have another project, which is the NDIS driver. NDIS driver is available for FreeBSD, and it allows the Windows driver to run on NetBSD. So this actually makes it possible to use certain network devices that think they're currently talking to Windows, but they're not. They're talking to Linux, FreeBSD, and now to NetBSD. We showed this student because this student has previous experience working with network driver support in NetBSD, and he had previous collaboration with the mentor. It actually happened to be a regular student-mentor relationship beforehand because he was the student of Phil Nelson's, and because Phil Nelson, as you may know, is a computer science professor, and this was one of his students. So he knew the students, he knew what he could expect from the students, and he picked them based on their relationship and the recommendation and on his experience. Those two don't live quite so far from each other. As I said, one is a student of the other, and they basically live in the same town. So you see here, different aspect of open source collaboration, which happens to be people sitting basically right next to each other. Doesn't make much of a difference to those people you've seen before on opposite sides of the country in the end, because the way the communications are done, based on the feedback I've gotten, was more or less exactly the same way the communication was done with larger relationships. People are talking about communicating over email, people are communicating over IRC or ICD, and everything worked out neatly. Alright, so what they said, what we need to do is, we want to produce a driver that is working well enough to use at least one specific card of wired Ethernet card on a PCI bus. There was a deliverable that was sent out, and then we had some long-term goals. We want to get a working driver for one or more PCMCI cards as well. We want to test the fixed box and multiprocessor system, test and make sure it works on 64-bit systems, and of course, be compatible and maintain clean code together with the development done in FreeBSD. This was a porting effort. It was an effort of taking code from one of our sister projects, FreeBSD, port it over, and then make it work there. But just doing that would be a heck job if they at the same time didn't take care to make sure that any other things that are done in the BSD driver are not also ported over, or at least are kept compatible, so you can easily share the code. So we hope that our changes that we have done can also be fed back to FreeBSD, where they can take advantage of maybe some of our portability layers, and where we can take advantage of other stuff that they have done there. Another long-term goal was to run it as a loadable kernel module, to not have it actually in the kernel, but load it as based on need. Are these projects, are these projects, I think the at the end of the official summer of code on September 1st, the Intel Ether Express programming card worked, and it was reliable, everything worked out fine. But the student has continued to work on this, and said, you know what, now let's see if my wireless card works too, and he added support for the Broadcom wireless card, which I believe we finished last week sometime, or 2 weeks ago, long after the code, or summer of code was already done, and long after we could grade him on this. And the mentor says, hey, I'm satisfied. The mentor says, I'm satisfied. We as a project are satisfied. We trust our mentors to be taking the student and overlooking them and to make the work sufficient. So the student, as I said, completed this work after the official end of the summer of code, which is what we hoped, or which we had hoped for all of our students. As I said, one of the goals of the summer of code, as far as we're concerned, is not just getting this one piece of work done, but rather to get people interested in our project and to have continuing work on this. People to get excited about this, that we can later on say, oh, maybe we want to have this person as a developer to take care of this particular driver that they're working on, or help out with this other stuff that they have learned over the summer. So this was very promising, that the student is still, even though he doesn't get any money anymore, he doesn't get any grade anymore, he's still working on this, so it seems like he got excited enough about open source work and the PSD to continue his work. The code has not yet been imported into the FDSC source tree, but we're looking on getting it there. The mentor will overlook the code, will review the code, and then hopefully import it before we have a feature freeze for FDSC 4.0. 4.0, you may say, wait a second, what's going on here? We are currently at 2.1. 2.1 is nearly imminent, coming up in, within the next couple of weeks. 3.0 will be coming up very soon. 4.0 is down the line, meaning the next major release after 3.0, which has been branched but not yet released. So we hope that in the next major release we can actually have this put in there and everybody can take advantage of this. We are often a little bit more conservative with our release engineer and other projects, but we hope that the quality speaks for itself. So, this one also gets a success. It gets a little bit of a bigger success, because the student is still interested, and I think it was just a better product. So therefore, a big, bold success. The next project that we mentioned is the TempFS, an efficient memory file system. Now what is this TempFS? We have, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but we have something called NFS, the memory file system, which is often used to mount, for example, /temp, or is often used when you netboot something, if you want to have certain file systems just mounted in memory, because you don't really need to have them on the disk, you want to be efficient, you want to be a little bit faster. But the memory file system is just our same old regular NFS just slapped on top of the virtual memory system. So it's not particularly designed for being efficient, for being fast, for doing the stuff that it actually is used for. Usually, if you have a memory-mounted file system on TempFS, you use this because you have files there that live very shortly, that are not particularly large, they're created quickly, they're deleted quickly, and you want to have access to them quickly. But this was not designed for this. However, so the student came up with this idea to say, you know what, we should really have a file system that is from the ground up designed for this particular purpose and nothing else. It will not try to do all these other things that other file systems try to do, but it will try to be efficient in memory and do things that it was designed for. So therefore, this is a completely new file system, which I think the student had only some reference papers for, conceptual idea, but now implementation is available. So this is different from the HFS+ implementation, where you actually have an implementation already. You've got a spec from Apple that you can work on. This one actually had to be designed from the ground up and be implemented. The student is Julio Merino Vidal, and he is overlooked by Luke Newberg and Bill Studenmark. If you're familiar with NetBSD, you may recognize Julio's name. He has been working with our package source system for a long time. Well over a year, 1.5 years, I believe, he's now with us. And he has said from the beginning, as a computer science student, I want to learn more about NetBSD's innards. I want to learn more about kernel work, about file systems. And so even though he already is a developer of the NetBSD project, he still saw the growing potential there to have somebody who does something completely different normally to actually learn more about NetBSD, and therefore we offered him this possibility. And working together with these inventors, he already had the background about certain things how NetBSD works, and it was easier for us to mentor him. We didn't have to take him as much by the hand as other ones did. Here we have a little bit more of a distribution of where they are and how they work together. We have Julio living down in Spain, we have Bill Steven living in San Diego, and we have Luke Newburn living down in Australia, way over there. Again, spanning the whole globe was not a problem, and the work collaboration worked out nicely as far as I've heard. So, the goals were an implementation of an efficient memory file system. But the student also said right from the beginning, the goal of this thing is not only just the file system, I also want to produce decent documentation at the same time, because I have a learning experience, I want to learn how to do this, other people will need to learn this too at some point. Just because I don't have any documentation doesn't mean everybody else will have to go through the same labor and figure out how things work. So he said, I want to make documentation an integral part of my project, which I thought was a great idea. He wants to also have a file system, how to document, which explains how to write a file system driver for NetBSD from scratch, which is also a lot of good code. So it was kind of nice that we could get actual code in there, but we could also kind of slip a little bit of a documentation project in there and make sure that this is not overlooked and not just handed in bare code that somebody else has to decipher later on. The CentFS project, I believe, has been agreed upon to be the most successful project in NetBSD. All goals were met completely. Our mentors have said this is top-notch work. It's really great to have this guy working on this. The product is really nice. It has already been imported into NetBSD Current recently. Has since then already seen a lot of work from other developers, because now that the summer of code is over, all the other file system experts can say, oh, wait a second, now we can do this, or now we need to do this. And they all chipped in, and we already fixed a whole bunch of bugs in there. It was compared with MFS, I think, just a couple of days ago. Somebody ran a couple of tests comparing the two file systems to see how they perform. Turns out, lo and behold, CentOS is not only more memory efficient or faster, but it also actually tells the truth. And NFS, turns out, is not quite accurate on reporting on the memory statistics that it's using. So it was nice to actually have this recently validated, this fresh new work in the source tree already imported to see that it's actually working more efficiently than what we had. Not only that, the student learned enough about file systems that right after he wrote this and imported this, he said, wait a second, I recently looked at this NFS code. What I noticed is, there's this bug in there, it's just not right. You've got all these structures that we keep usually out of the kernel code. We have them in the kernel code, mixed with the user end code, and it's not in the NFS code itself. So he noticed that, he cleaned it up, committed it, so we already have somebody who's now apparently a file system expert, just based on these couple of weeks that he spent writing CentOS for us. You should expect an article on CentOS on online, the O'Reilly website, where you often see BSD-related articles. I know that the student has committed to writing an article for there, and this will be published, I assume, in a couple of weeks, hopefully. So this has definitely been rated a success by us. Yes, well, I'm not really sure, because I'm not really familiar with all this. I assume that the what I read in the email when I saw the reports is that NFS actually claims to be using less memory than it actually is. Right. Yes. So you may be right there. But, as I said, I'm unfortunately not an expert. But feel free to shoot the guy an email. I'm sure you'll be happy to help him out. How do we go about importing the new code? Well, in this case, we actually had the advantage, as I said, the student himself was already a NetBSD developer, so he already had the privileges to do that. What we have done on September 1st is we have taken a snapshot of all the different projects that we have on source code, and we said, okay, we first of all need to have one snapshot just to be able to give it to Google if they're interested, to show anybody else what the work is like at the date that they have to hold the pencils down. Work has since, of course, continued on all the different projects, all the different modules, and the people who will import other parts of other projects, they will simply look at the code, integrate it into the current repository, and then commit it either by allowing the student access, by integrating the student becoming a developer, or like saying, okay, I'm committing this for the student, and I will accept patches from the student, and then we will see about mentorship. You don't have to change the code, no. Because it's not overlapping, it's because the code has all these projects been designed for NetBSD. So what they have, what all these projects have done is they said, okay, you check out the source code from NetBSD, and then you take these files that I have over here, put them into this directory, put them into that directory, or apply this patch, and then you could just compile your kernel, for example, and for HFS support, and then you've got HFS support, similarly for TendFS, who has used the same way. So all of them have integrated, I have been working with NetBSD source repository from the start, so it's very easy for other people to follow the code, to say, I'm downloading this from SourceForge, I'm downloading this from NetBSD CVS repository, and I can make them work together. But once they're integrated, which is of course the ultimate goal, everything looks much nicer for us. And as I said, this one has been our most successful project, and we're very glad that everything worked out this way. We have another file system project, which was called UserFS, the User Space File System Hooks, which was an idea which was developed by Antti Kanti, who you also may know. He also happens to be an existing NetBSD developer, but he also is a computer science student at the University of Technology in Helsinki. And he said, okay, I've got this great idea, which may or may not become his master thesis, which I think it will be actually, to make it possible to write a file system in user space or an application will see no difference to the pure internal file system. So you have a certain abstraction layer between the file system that you can actually allow users in user space not to need to grab into the kernel so much. You let the kernel do a little bit of work and let the user then do other work and present it to you if it was a regular file system. Again, we have a mentor that we have developed by Bill Stevenhorst living in San Diego. Is this intended to work without root privileges? I don't think so, no. I'm not really familiar with this either. I don't think it is intended to be without root privileges, at least not at this point. I believe what is intended is it's more an example of saying we can do this in a user-land level. We don't have to actually create all these kernel calls to let the kernel take care of this. But again, I would have to unfortunately refer you to the actual student or to our mailing list. We have for all of these projects, any and all discussions have been going on our mailing list unless they have been held in private between the mentors and the students. And we have always said, the policy that we have within the NetBSD project is, anything that can be in the open will be in the open. So the only time we have discussions that are not in our public mailing list is if there is some security or some privacy concern. And similarly, we have tried to keep this up with our students and say, keep your discussions on our mailing list, anybody can follow them, anybody can see what progress you're making, and anybody can make suggestions here. So I believe, here we have again, Arthur, you will notice, as I said before, the student in San Diego, and this is his third project with which he's mentoring, so he took on quite a chunk of work there. And we have Antti sitting over in Helsinki. This was rated by our mentors as to be one of the most ambitious projects, but also one of the more interesting ones, one of the most interesting ones. It supposedly consists of these three parts, the kernel file description, the communications protocol, and the user-led API for the file system to use. The implementation for the Google Summer of Code also provides a trivial user-led file system to demonstrate functionality. Now, I'm not sure if you know Antti. Antti has a very good sense of humor. So what he actually called it, because he likes to cook, and he recently read a book on puff pastry, he decided to call it the puff FS, Pass to User Space file system by adding another acronym. So the way that you envision this, that you have an application that then does make some kernel system calls, of course, EFS for example, certain kernel pops as he calls them. Then you get into the user space pops where you have your file system implementation entirely in the user OS, which then again calls its user space pops, kernel pops, going back to the application. Now, as I said, I regret that I can't really answer any questions on this or give you any more details on this. I really encourage you to A, contact the students, ask the mailing list if you want to know about these things, and you can continue your discussion with those people. The result turned out to be, well, it's still bare bones. Ansi, well, he's working hard. Also, he's one of those people who subscribe to the deadline dictates magazine. So he said, okay, I kind of work. Oh no, oh my god, is that late? No, I really work. This is what he did. However, nevertheless, a simple file system with some hard-coded files, which are modifiable and have been written. As he says, the framework calls for them to avoid complete and utter defeat, which, as you may know, among NetBSD developers, is not necessarily the maxim that we will say as success. But it also shows that you have made progress and that you're honest with yourself. You know where your limitations are. So the code has not yet been imported, and it will probably be a couple of weeks before we can get to importing it as experimental code. But we have developers that are interested in keeping it in the source tree and building it there and continue working there. Also, some of code criteria that they set out or the goals were met. So we can be optimistically rated as a success. We have another project, we have the white character support for curses project. White character support for curses was not available in NetBSD curses. It is available in the new GPL curses, but we being the BSD, we would like to have our source code BSD license and our curses library extended that way. Since we do not have white character support for curses, we have only limited support for internationalized character sets. This, of course, is particularly important in the Asian market, where you actually need white character support in order to be able to have terminals that show correctly the different character sets that are available there. There are quite many of them. So, we had police, we had two developers overlooking the code being written by our students, Rudy LP, and the developers, mentoring developers were Julian Coleman and Fred Lutz. Now these two, again, are spending a little bit around the globe. We've got Rudy all sitting in China there. We've got Julian in London, I think, or near London actually. And we have Brett down in Australia. It turns out, yes, that very detailed documentation on the website. I have to admit again, I don't know the details about this. I had to scramble a little bit for this presentation. And reading through this is a very, very detailed documentation where you can actually see which files are modified and what you thought about how these data structures need to be changed. And over here you see a screenshot of actual code being written using this character set, using the curses library. So this turns out you actually have met all the goals. Mentors reported to me that everything works fine and the code will be imported into the NetBSD source tree real soon now, so we expect it to happen this year. And this too gets a thumbs up from us. We have ZeroConf over here, our NetBSD ZeroConf project, which has a staggering number of mentoring NetBSD developers and one student as before. It turns out in this case that we have four mentoring developers because we couldn't find a single person that would willingly say, okay, I'm overlooking this student. So we have to say, would you be willing to help that person overlook this student? And would you be willing to help that person? So we ended up with quite a number of them. I hope that Christos might actually show up here so he could fill in on this, but unfortunately he's not here. So here you see them. We've got four mentors, the yellow dots, and we've got some of you in Italy over there. The work was split into two parts. We have a daemon which auto-configures an IPv4 linked local address to a network interface, and another one, a library for multicast DNS, which is used to resolve local network hosting to discover available services in the network where there is no DNS server. You can see what ZeroConf is about. There's another website. I later on have a whole bunch of slides on references so you can find out more. ZeroConf.org is the website if you're currently online. You want to take a look at what this is about. As a result, we have implemented ZeroConf E. We have implemented, well, he has implemented Responder E. Both are working, but they both need a little bit more work. Import into the NetBSD CDS repository is not there yet, and it turns out we had too many mentors. This is one of the lessons that we learned as a mentoring organization. From an organizational point of view, you cannot have too many people overlooking the student, because then you actually need more formal ways of communication between them. If you have a one-to-one relationship, if you have a two-to-one relationship, they can just email each other and figure things out. It turns out if you have four mentors and one student, communication gets a little bit more complex, and it probably could have been a better project if we had one dedicated mentor or maybe two dedicated mentors, one of them four. They said, yeah, I kind of will look this over. Nevertheless, the goals that were set out were met. It gets a small success from us, not such an enthusiastic one as the other one. But nevertheless, as we said, everything that was set out to be done was done in the other time frame. So we recommend that your elective student gets the full money for this project as well. And we will look into seeing more work on this in the future with the students and with more enthusiastic mentors. And finally, our last project that we have here is our BPG, our BSD License Privacy Guard, which said, why do we need this? Well, first of all, there is no BSD License Open BPG tool available right now. There is none. We have GNU-PG, but that has its own shortcomings. It's GPL licensed, and if you use it regularly, it's got the most horrible human interface I've ever seen. The command line options use plurals with singulars, double dashes, super wrong, and you don't really know what exactly it is if you're doing. You don't know if it is download service, keys from server, or if it's fetch keys, or fetch key, or whatnot. So there are certain problems with this just based on the tool that is available. You could say, right, you could just change that. But then again, we also want to have a BSD license implementation that we can import into our source tree, that we can ship with our operating system without actually having to rely on GPL code. And let's see what we've got here. So we've got our student, Mother and Private, and he has done previous work on a similar tool, which is why he was chosen. Not only did he show that he has a big understanding of this whole thing, but he actually had done PyPGP, which was a very bare-bones PGP implementation that was available in SourceForge, which he has now abandoned in favor of the BPG or BSD Privacy Guard. Overlooked by two of our senior developers, Alistair Crooks and Kurt Sampson, whose names you all probably recognize and they pop up regularly. The three of them are spread out over here. Actually, I believe it's not quite accurate. I believe that Kurt is currently in Japan and not over here in New York, but he's where his residence is. And Alistair lives near London. The BSD Privacy Guard is a BSD license program that performs authentication and encryption using the OpenPGP standard IEC 2440. It provides a set of libraries for signing and encrypting data, allowing the integration of OpenPGP features in other applications. This is essential to us. We want to be able to integrate this into other applications. We don't necessarily want to have it just as this one tool. We often have the need to encrypt files, to verify signatures, and this is something that should not be completely separate. We want to have a modular PGP cryptography toolkit that allows users to choose their own encryption and signing algorithms, key management and structure and so on, and a scriptable and well thought out command line interface built over these libraries. This should be a suitable replacement for the new PG or PGP. This was not written as a complete drop-in replacement for new PG, for example. We don't want to just say, oh, we've got this new tool, we can use it any way we like with the other one. No, we want to actually have a toolkit there that we can integrate with other applications and provide an interface around this to these libraries that we can then use to make these calls. This project I have found to be the most, the best documented one. When you look at the website for this project, you will find very detailed discussion of the deliverables, of what were the design goals, how to do these things. A lot of saying, oh, wait a second, this is not the right way. Scrap this, I'm going back to the drawing board. And that was one of the feedback that I've gotten from the mentors. The mentor said, this dude was very enthusiastic, and the good thing is, we could actually keep him from writing code right away. Because the student wants to jump in and write his implementation, and the dementors were able to actually hold it back a little bit and say, wait a second, let's think about this more clearly. Let's spend more time on the design phase before we start actually coding. And this is what they have done, and as a result, we have very great documentation for this already. We, of course, have the main users supported our data confidentiality. The library must support different algorithms, and it aims to be symmetric and asymmetric encryption, so both we have there. We want to have data integrity and authentication, and we want to have integrated key management. So we want to do all these things that we are used to from an OpenPGP implementation. So, the goals were to provide a complete implementation with only the exception of possible old format incompatibility, settled on the basis of a well-thought-out and well-designed data security framework, and develop a commander interface that is both A, powerful, meaning it must support all the functionality, but also actually usable, meaning that users can do this, users can deal with it. This is particularly important with such a tool that wants to provide security. If the user interface is not easy to understand, the user will not use it. Therefore, it cannot provide security if the user doesn't understand how to use it. For a security-related tool, it's incredibly important to have a very easy, understandable interface, and they actually focus on this too. We wanted to design certain libraries and design them with the folks in accessibility. So we want to have them be used. A lot of people will hopefully be a candidate to replace GNU-PG on various platforms. The main goal was to provide this toolkit, which was split into different libraries, again, which allow us to actually integrate it with other tools. One of the tools that they actually gave an example or implementation for was for our package tools. You may not know this, but our package add command is designed to actually verify a signature if it is present. Currently, what it does is it allows a signature of none, or it allows a signature of type GNU-PG. If it is of type GNU-PG, it makes a call out, calls GNU-PG actually with the appropriate command and switches to verify the signature. This is somewhat burdensome, and we would like to have this as a library system, so we can just say, you know what, we can support this format too, we just pull in the library, link it again to our package add tools, and then can verify signatures. And this has actually been made to work in this project, and so we're looking very much forward to getting this into our tree and to be able to deal with this. You can see the modular design from these 4 points that actually split the libraries into the different areas, which also kind of makes sense. We've got the securing data architecture library bit in BPG, which does the majority of the work here, which relies, of course, on other libraries. It relies on the key management library, and then the algorithms library, and similarly on the compression library for certain causes. In this case, it uses libzip for our purposes, because libzip happens to be also BSD license and happens to be maintained by 2 of our developers, so therefore we're very happy to include this. This is the design of libbpg. We have the key management library, which is split into these submodules, so key fetcher, key generator, key importer, exporter, key interpreter, key deliverer. As I said, all these bullet points here I've blankly taken shamelessly from the website, from their documentation. They provide very good documentation for this, and they actually can give you more in-depth of how these things work. Of course, these slides will later on be available online, and you can, at your leisure time, read through them yourself. We have the libpg trust library, which handles the trust database and the trust policy, which contains a list of user ID and trust level pairs. Policy defines the rules for deriving the trust level of a given key from a trust database. The algorithms library, which we have with the hash function SHA-1, or currently, these are the three supported, the 4 supported algorithms that we have, SHA-1, AES, RSA, and DSA. But since it's an extendable design, we hope to be able to add other algorithms in there. I'm sure that you will probably get Tiger in there at some point, because I know that Alistair Crooks has been working on that support for that reason. The BPG algo may offer with a plugin system that will take these packages. Yes, Tiger, there's another algorithm called Tiger. it's not back. This may offer, so the idea is to also offer this with a plugin system. It would be a really nice idea to allow users to write plugins for this library to add more functionality and to add other support for other algorithms without actually having to go in there. All right, the standard security issues that arise in any tool that deals with encryption or security, in this case, apply here equally. You have to make sure that you crush your memory. You have to make sure that you do not, for example, core dump while you count encrypting something. And you have to maintain the integrity of the keyring. These are all the things that they have addressed in their documentation and, of course, in the code itself. And you can read actual examples of how they address these things on the website to which I refer you. So the result here, this is, I think, the second best summer code project that we've had. Very good work, very mature code. Both mentors have said that the student was great to work with, student has delivered what they expected from him. All goals were set, were achieved. We have detailed documentation available. The result is still in development on SourceForge. We have not yet brought into our source tree. We are currently discussing how we can bring it into our source tree. But one of the problems is that we want to have the student be still enthusiastic and continue to work on it, but the student is not yet a developer. As you may know, in NetBSD, we also have a mentorship student relationship in order to get a new developer. Any new developer has to have a sponsor who suggests them, and there's a certain number of weeks that go by where the developer body reviews the previous work, and where eventually the student may or may not get accepted, and then has to work under supervision for a couple of weeks or for a certain time before they can freely commit code. This takes a certain amount of time. We hope to get Manuel on board very soon. I think Alistair has said he might be initiating the process to get him on board as a developer, but he's not right now. However, he's still writing code on this. He's still interested in working on this, and therefore we do not want to import it into our source tree where he cannot commit the code himself. So we said, let's keep it on SourceForge for now, where he can just continue to commit everything he needs to, and then we can see how we can get into our tree when he becomes a developer, hopefully soon. He has written an article for Dr. Goss Journal, which is, I think, supposed to be coming out in the December issue, I believe, but I'm not sure on that. This was another perk of the Summer of Code. That's Dr. Goss Journal, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, it's a fairly respected programmer's journal, has said at the end of the Summer of Code, you know what, why don't you tell your students they can write an article about their project and you publish it. We will make a special Summer of Code issue, or we will publish three or four every month or so. And so they have offered this space for the students in their magazine to show them how they worked on this. Manuel has written a nice article on this, which will be published, which has been submitted to Dr. Goss Journal and will be published very soon. And we're looking forward to seeing more results from there. So clearly, this one also is a more enthusiastic success project. All right. This brings me back now to the end of my slides, and I'm quite surprised I actually managed to stall so much time here. I thought it would be much shorter, but anyway, we have general references that you can check out when you have the time to find out more about NetBSD within the Summer of Code. In particular, we have our NetBSD set, of course, we have NetBSD stock source forge. Somehow package shows that in there, which probably shouldn't have. Anyway, I'll check it out before I put this online. We've got our list of current projects, we've got our press release, and I've got our little map of where developers are online on my website. You can take a look there if you want to talk around there. And I have a couple of more slides with more references so that you can look up. But I just want, before I close this, want to emphasize how excited we are about this. We are very glad that all seven of our projects actually turned out to be successful. And I know this is not the norm. Looking at the other projects that they have reported, almost every single project reported results of their students said, well, we've got a whole bunch of yays, but we also have a couple of nays. Several people said they had no-shows. They had people who went completely AWOL during the project. Several had students who delivered code that was subpar that they could not really work with. But of course, they all also had great work, and I expect that when we see next month, previously talking, that we also see great work there. But I must say that I was surprised that all seven of us, even the ones that already said, they need a little bit more work, still redeemed the success, which I'm very glad about. And it speaks for the students, and I think it kind of also speaks for NetBSD, because it shows you the kind of people we attract and the kind of people we want to attract. Because we do put emphasis on correctness of the code and the high quality, we hope that we can actually attract the students that are interested in this too, And even if it turns out that you only get a smaller number, we are very glad that we rather have a smaller number where everybody is a success and have a large number where we actually have to weed out the good from the bad. So I'm very glad about that, and I'm very thankful for the students for the work they did. I'm very thankful for Google to actually offer this. I know that many people nowadays are a little bit suspicious of Google because they take on everything and they own everything. But in this particular instance, I cannot see a downside. They get exposure, if they want to hire other people, they get open source code that they can use. We get open source code, the students get money, we get money per student. People get t-shirts, even less. So, all in all, I'm very glad that this whole thing worked out the way it did. And this pretty much ends my presentation. Unless you have any questions. Yes, pretty much actually. Google has said, inofficially, and I'm not sure how far I'm supposed to repeat this here, that under very certain circumstances, they might, under very certain circumstances, they might accept it. If somebody says, this student worked great, but he had like a death in the family, he couldn't complete his work, give him a partial, yes. But otherwise, it was either A or A. It is completely up to the mentor to decide whether or not the student gets the 4.5K for dollars later on. Right, exactly. If they get the other four, the 500 they got beforehand. So again, as we said, it's a possibility that some of these no-shows just apply it, got the $500 in rent. But then again, if you think about how much effort is put into a successful application, that's pretty much worth $500. So therefore, it's not really that much of a win for those people, if anybody did it. I don't know that. But it was up to the developers to say, to the mentors to say, yes, I recommend this student should get the money, because it did all the work, or they said, well, this student really didn't necessarily do the job. And I understand there's a certain pressure on the mentors to actually say, yes, you should get the money. Of course, there is the pressure. But I, looking at the stuff that I've gone over, getting the feedback from my developers, from our mentors that I've tried to coach in this whole project, I very much trust them, and I'm quite sure that the code that we have here is actually of the quality that they say, and the one that we have imported, we're good.
On the other hand, as a mentor, you don't want to say yes to crap and get a bad
Exactly, decision. Exactly. It's always the same thing. If you are a mentor for somebody, you represent them, and they represent you. So if somebody lists you as a mentor, exactly. So, as I said, I trust our mentors to actually make the right decision, and I'm very glad for this. Alright. Thank you. So,
a lot of us kind of followed what was going on, and to be honest, my interest or my following kind of fell off when it actually started, you know, for whatever reason, but I'm kind of interested in just the whole concept, you know, of Netflix just raised a bunch of money, right? I don't expect any coordination between the DMC projects itself, and that would be sort of a civil war in Iraq, right? But what about actually, you know, without Google or something like this happening?
Yeah, you know? That's an interesting question.
A bit more structured, a bit more kind of newsish, contemporary. There's a lot of things out there that actually,
yeah.
When you think about like what OpenSSH did for OpenDSC, or you think a whole number of different projects and things that have come up, you take a few of those projects, you get $500 for a student for 2 weeks of work, which I don't know, when I was a student that was a lot of money. You know, something more structured like that, where actually you lead projects and assign students.
Right. This is something that I think actually has come up as a result of this. I think it's simply turned out that nobody had really thought specifically of saying, you know what, how about we give up money for people to write open source code necessarily in the scale. So, and it's true what you say, this one was not very structured at all. As I said, we had to scramble a lot to get our shit together, to get people organized, and I'm sure the other project had similar experiences. So it would be nice to actually see this done again with more structure, with or without corporate funding. It's totally something that the BSD family could do together. For example, they could say, you know what, let's pool resources, let's say everybody puts up in money and we can, say, make a contest, right? Whatever feature would be useful to all three of them. But in this one, we also are, excuse me, we from NetBSD were also very much looking at the results or at the projects from FreeBSD. When we made our decision of what kind of project units to have, we looked at what FreeBSD has, what applications they might have. We talked to a couple of people, and we said, you know what? They are certainly overlapping to a certain degree. If you've got something, we encourage our developers to look at their code. That's what we encourage FreeBSD people to look at our code, and we're looking forward to sharing this stuff between us, and hopefully all this will work out as we plan.
Clearly the types of projects that where there could be any overlap. I mean, you could say, you know, the HFS support could be overlap, but at the end of the day,
right.
You know, I mean, you're talking to
a
user-land application.
Right, user applications are much easier in that respect, especially since between the three BSDs, the file system code and the different ports, the different platforms has diverged sufficiently that it's more difficult, that's true. But nevertheless, I think that the students not necessarily need to focus only on one of the platforms. Like, we had this one supporting something from FreeBSD over to NetBSD, so I would hope that there's something similar in the other opposite direction.
What about another third party actually going on? I mean, like, a university or Yahoo.
Right.
I mean, or somebody like that. I mean, do you think that's a possibility? Or they would say, you know, we'll give you X amount, this is going to be a BSD project, give us your proposals.
Yeah, I personally I'm very open to the idea, and I like the idea very much that we could get our resources funneled together to get this going. The problem I see is that with any large corporation, you have so much overhead in just plain old politics and organizational stuff. I know that the Google people did, as far as I'm concerned, amazing work. They had to deal with all the different tax laws in all the different countries that people applied to. They had to deal with their own tax situation to figure out how they can actually give money to those people. Any corporation that would say, I want to give money to something, has to deal with a lot of paperwork. So I don't know. I don't have any experience in that area. So, you know, just my two cents. All right. Well, thank you very much.
The last thing is, I've never remembered the name of the bar, but you go out the door, we'll all meet outside, and then what you do is you make a right, you go down to West Broadway, and you make a left at West Broadway. But I don't remember the name of the bar, so.